During those days, another large crowd gathered. Since they had nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples to him and said, I have compassion for these people. They've already been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them home hungry, they will collapse on the way because some of them have come a long distance. His disciples answered, but where in this remote place can anyone get enough bread to feed them? How many loaves do you have? Jesus asked. Seven, they replied. He told the crowd to sit down on the ground. When he had taken the seven loaves and given thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to distribute to the people, and they did so. They had a few small fish as well. He gave thanks for them also and told the disciples to distribute them. The people ate and were satisfied. Afterwards, the disciples picked up seven basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over. About 4,000 were present. After he'd sent them away, he got into the boat with his disciples and went to the region of Dalmanutha, possibly. The Pharisees came and began to question Jesus. To test him, they asked him for a sign from heaven. He sighed deeply and said, why does this generation ask for a sign? Truly, I tell you, no sign will be given to it. Then he left them, got back into the boat, and crossed to the other side. Let me do a quick poll of the room, because I wasn't sure how kind of relevant this would be as a kind of cultural touch point. So just hands up in the room if you've seen the film Groundhog Day. Look at that. Like, I never hit something that's been seen. So it was big when I was like a teenager. I think it came out when I was about 10. And I couldn't work out whether it was just like part of my upbringing or part of everyone's upbringing. I couldn't work out if everyone's seen it. But it seems like most people have seen the film Groundhog Day, which is great because it means that I won't lose like 90% of you in my first 5 minutes as I talk about something you've never heard of. Groundhog Day tells the story of a rather unpleasant weatherman who goes to a kind of sleepy town in America for Groundhog Day, which is a day where a groundhog comes out and somehow predicts something about what's going to happen. Like, if he looks one way, something's going to happen, and if he looks another way, something's going to happen. This is the basic story. But of course, that's not what anybody knows about Groundhog Day, because that's not the important thing. The important thing about Groundhog Day is that he has a relatively ordinary day. He does this stuff. He goes to bed. He wakes up the next morning, only to find that he now has to relive the same day over again. And so he wakes up, it's the same song on the radio, he goes out, the same things are happening. The only thing that seems to change is him and what he can do. Now to begin with, this feels amazing, right? It's like, I get to live this day over and over and over again. I can do whatever I want without any fear of any consequences, right? Like, I can spend as much money as I want, I can do whatever I want, because as soon as I go to bed, it's all just going to reset the next day. It doesn't matter what I do, this is going to be amazing. Not only that, but he's basically got infinite time now to get really good at things. So, you know, he can get amazing at ice sculpting and playing the piano and a whole variety of things, because he never grows old. He can just live the same day, and each day he can get a bit better on the piano until by the end he's a sort of virtuoso. It's just seems amazing to begin with. But after a while, he starts to get a bit fed up of just living the same day over and over again. Because it's a bit like living a life on a treadmill, right? Like, a lot of energy, but no hope of ever getting anywhere. You know, you can never go, oh, well, if I do this, then this might happen. Because that's never going to come. That future's never going to happen. You can't build anything. You can't work towards anything. There's no progress. You're not going anywhere. Everything becomes a bit meaningless. And so he starts to try and work out, is there any way I can get out of this loop that I'm stuck in of just living the same day over and over again? Like, what do I need to do to get out of it? But he can't work out what it is. He tries all kinds of things, but every morning he wakes up just stuck, same day over and over again. Until he starts to live a life that's a little bit less unpleasant. Until he starts to live a life that's a little bit less selfish, until he starts to care for other people and about other people, until he's able to abandon his selfishness and actually put himself out for someone else, he just continues on this loop. But once that lesson is learnt, he wakes up one morning and finds that he's out of the loop. Today is actually finally tomorrow, and his life can continue. And, you know, the point of the story is a bit like A Christmas Carol or one of those kind of stories. The point of it is He's gonna keep living this experience until he's learned the lesson he needs to learn from it. He's gonna be stuck here until he's learned what he needs to learn. Now, he doesn't understand that that's what's going on. He doesn't understand when he's in the middle of it that there's this lesson he needs to learn, and until he learns it, he'll never be able to escape this. But that is what's going on. Now, I don't know what you felt as we read that section of Mark that we've just read together. But if you're familiar with the book of Mark, so if you've read Mark before or recently, or if you've just been around Grace Church for the last few weeks, you might have felt a little bit like we're stuck in some sort of Groundhog Day. Because if you flick back just a couple of pages, so just to Mark 6, so just like flick the page over, you'll see there is an incredibly similar story where Jesus feeds the 5,000. The numbers are marginally different. The location is a bit different, but fundamentally, the same stuff happens. Lots of people hear Jesus teach. They get really hungry. Jesus says to the disciples, look, we need to feed them. The disciples go, how on earth are we going to feed thousands of people? We haven't got any food. Jesus takes a bit of bread and some fish, distributes it around it, and feeds them. And at the end, there's a whole load of basketfuls of food left over. It's basically the kind of key elements of this story are very, very similar to the feeding of the 5,000. So the question I think we have to think about when we're reading this is twofold. One, why does Jesus feel the need to repeat this miracle? So why is he doing it again? And maybe more importantly, because he might just be doing it again because he's got another group of hungry people who he needs to feed. But more importantly, why does Mark feel the need to include them both? You know, he's told a story just like this before. Why tell us something that's basically the same? Why not tell us something different, something more original that Jesus did? We know Jesus did lots of other things because we can read about them in some of the other biographies. Why didn't Mark tell us about one of those? Why does he tell us this story? And I think the key to understanding this is what Mark includes in this second section, verse 14 down to 21. So let me read that for us now, and then we'll see where that takes us. The disciples had forgotten to bring bread, except for one loaf that they had with them in the boat. Be careful, Jesus warned them. Watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod. They discussed with one another and said, it's because we have no bread. Aware of their discussion, Jesus asked them, why are you talking about having no bread? Do you still not see or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes but fail to see and ears but fail to hear? And don't you remember when I broke the five loaves for the 5,000, how many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up? 12, they replied. And when I broke the seven loaves for the 4,000, how many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up? They answered, seven. He said to them, do you still not understand? This is the most striking bit about this section. Is in this section, Jesus basically asks seven questions to the disciples. Why are you talking about having no bread? Do you still not see or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes but fail to see and ears but fail to hear? Don't you remember? And when I broke the loaves, how many baskets did you pick up? Do you still not understand? In just a few verses, Jesus hits the disciples with this barrage of question after question after question, all getting at, have you still not got it? Have you still not understood what's going on here? Why does Jesus need to do this again? Why does Mark include this story? Well, it's because the disciples really needed to understand what Jesus was trying to teach them here, and they still hadn't got it. They really needed to understand it. Like Groundhog Day, the disciples needed to keep seeing and keep hearing the same things until they finally understood it. Until they finally got what it was all about. I don't know how you felt when I got to the end of that section that I just read and it says, do you still not understand? I love the way this passage reads out. Because you get to the end and you say, do you still not understand? And I'm looking going, I'm not actually sure. I'm not sure I do actually understand. He says it in such a way as if, like, come on, it's so obvious. Like, why haven't you got it yet? But I get to the end and I'm like, I don't know. And then you read on to the next verse, it's like, oh, I'm not helping you out. He's like, Mark's not giving anything away here. He's like, do you still not understand? And then he's like, great, I'll read the next verse. He'll tell me the answer. Nope, new story. That's it. You're left on this huge cliffhanger of, do you still not get it? He says it as if it should be obvious, but it doesn't feel obvious to me. And it strikes me that this is true of many of the things that God says and many of the things that God teaches us. You see, God created us with minds and with imaginations. And often, he wants us to use our minds and our imaginations to engage with him. He wants us to wrestle with ideas and concepts and thoughts and ideas. Because often it's when you wrestle with something that you really understand it. It's when you wrestle with something that really goes deep and actually stays with you. If someone tells me something, I just instantly forget it. But if I have to work it out, that stays with me. The fun of this section, really, is trying to answer the question, what is it we're meant to have understood? That's the fun of reading this. That's what has entertained me throughout this week as I've been preparing this talk, is just coming back to that question. What is it I was meant to understand? Thinking, oh, maybe it's this. Oh, maybe it's that thing. Oh, maybe Jesus is getting at this. Wrestling with these ideas. In the same way as, you know, you could have had a very short Groundhog Day film where someone just said to Bill Murray, have you tried being a bit nicer? And he went, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. And then was a bit nicer. It would be less entertaining as a film, but it would get you there. But the reality is that doesn't often work, does it? Just telling people, oh, yeah, have you tried being a bit nicer, doesn't get you there. But living, going over and over the same period, wrestling with what is it I'm meant to be learning here, that's when change happens. You know, it's by chewing over, meditating on what Jesus wants us to understand, that will have a much bigger impact than just propositional truths ever will. So, I've given us the setup. What is it we're meant to understand? Here goes. I'm gonna suggest three things that I think the disciples have failed to understand. And I think these are more than just, you know, I was lying in bed and an idea popped into my head. I think there's clues given to us in the specifically in the questions that Jesus asks. You know, the reason why he asks seven questions is because he's trying to direct them to what it is he wants them to understand. So I think there's clues given in the specific questions he asks about what it is that the disciples and what it is that we're meant to learn from this. It's worth saying, I've got three here. I think there may be more. But you can chat about that in life groups. Life groups are a great space for us to come together and just look at this and just go, hey, I wondered if Jesus may be pointing us in this direction. And you can chat about that and see how legit that isn't or isn't. And that'd be a great thing to do this week. So here goes. The first thing I think the disciples get wrong that Jesus wants them to understand is highlighted by the first question he asks them. He asks them, why are you still talking about bread? You know, why are you still going on about bread? And on the one hand, that seems obvious because bread has dominated everything that's happened for the last sort of two chapters of Mark, from the feeding of the 5,000 to the crumbs that fall off the table. You know, bread's been a big idea. So on the one hand, it's obvious why they're talking about bread. And Jesus has just said about the yeast of the Pharisees and Herod. And so they're kind of going, okay, there's this thing about yeast that Jesus wants us to get, and there's been all this bread chat, and we haven't bought any bread. And so they're like, hey, we're talking about bread here. Like, this is a bread-themed conversation. But, of course, the reality is Jesus isn't actually all that concerned about bread. In fact, this latest interaction, Jesus isn't talking about bread at all, which is why he asked them the question, why are you talking about bread? Because he's not trying to teach them something about bread. This is not, you know, the Galilean bake-off. This is trying to teach them about the Pharisees and Herod. And specifically, he's trying to warn them against the ability of the Pharisees, the religious leaders of the days, and Herod, the kind of local ruler of the day, to corrupt things. You know, just like a little bit of yeast, when it gets into a loaf, gets everywhere. That's the picture he has in mind. You know, a little bit of Pharisaism, a little bit of Herod will get in and it'll permeate through everything. It'll get everywhere. So beware it. If you allow a little bit of Pharisaism or a little bit of Herod into your faith, it will end up changing the whole makeup of your faith. Let me just suggest how that might be. Allow a little bit of the Pharisees into your faith and you will end up rejecting Jesus in favor of tradition and custom. It's what he said in Mark 7, just before this. You will end up rejecting forgiveness in favor of law keeping. You will end up rejecting faith in favor of external behaviors. So Jesus has just warned them about the Pharisees focused on the external. And now he's saying, don't even give it an inch. Don't give it any space. Just stay well away from that kind of faith, a faith that's obsessed with laws and traditions and those things instead of with forgiveness and internal change. Similarly, we've just had a story about Herod just before this. And so what's he saying happens if you let a little bit of Herod into your faith? Well, if you allow a little bit of Herod into your faith, what you'll do is you'll end up doing whatever is needed to silence Jesus, to stop yourself having to listen to him. When God's trying to talk, you'll do whatever is necessary to not listen so that you can justify your current behaviors. That's what Herod does. He does whatever he needs to do so that no one is going to challenge his behaviors and so that he can kind of keep his reputation. You see, Jesus isn't even talking about bread here, which is why he asks the question, why are you guys still going on about bread? So why are they? Why are they still talking about bread? Well, surely it's because so often the physical thing, bread, feels a lot more real to us than its spiritual equivalent. I mean, isn't that true for many of us? Like, our physical needs feel more real than our spiritual needs often. Our physical desires feel so much stronger than our spiritual desires. The disciples are talking about bread because they understand bread and they can see bread and they can touch bread, and bread feels important to them. They can get their heads around what bread is. But Jesus is actually much more concerned with our spiritual needs and desires than our physical ones. In fact, he often uses feeding miracles as an illustration in which he says, I am the bread of life. I am the spiritual bread you need. Just as bread satisfies your physical hunger, so I, Jesus, not me, so I will satisfy your spiritual hunger. That's Jesus' point. That's what he wants people to understand. Now, it strikes me that surely this is something that we should be all over as a culture, because most of us in this room do not battle with physical hunger. You know, most of us do not have to worry about where our next meal is coming from. We have enough food to eat. But we do battle with spiritual hunger. I think as a culture, perhaps more than ever, we know what it is to be spiritually hungry. We know what it is to feel guilty and in need of forgiveness. We know what it is to feel directionless and in need of purpose. We know what it is to feel isolated and in need of connection and relationships. We know what it is to feel empty and in need of the divine. Surely, as a culture, we should be more concerned with spiritual hunger than physical hunger. Surely, because it's just a bigger issue for us. Clearly, it's a bigger issue for us. And yet, despite this, we're so tempted to make our faith and our Christianity dominated by the physical. We make our faith about physical, material things. Just let me give you some examples of how we do it. We have a faith which goes something like this. If I follow God and do what he asks me to, he will make me healthier and wealthier and more prosperous. You know, a faith that is obsessed with physical things. Or maybe you do it the other way. Maybe you don't do that, but maybe you do it the other way. If bad things are happening to me, it must be because I've done something wrong or because God isn't there or because he doesn't love me. When I get a promotion, God is good, but when I lose my job, God is bad. Or how about your prayer life? What do you spend your time asking Jesus for? Strikes me our prayer lives are often dominated by physical needs, new jobs, sickness, suffering. But we actually spend no time asking him to grow us spiritually in love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and goodness and meekness and self-control. You see, we have a faith that's dominated by the physical. We're like the disciples still hung up on the bread. When Jesus is like, whoa, I'm not talking about bread anymore. I'm talking about your faith. I'm talking about how you feed your soul. About what it looks like to be a human being that doesn't just have physical needs, but also is created with spiritual needs and spiritual hunger. I think that's the first thing they don't understand. When Jesus says, haven't you understood yet? I think the first thing they don't understand is that it's not about bread. It was always about forgiveness and spiritual life. I was watching an episode of The Bear a few days ago, which is a TV show about a chef, not about bears. And it was the one, for those of you who've seen it, it's the one where Sugar is giving birth. And she goes into labor and she rings round all the people she knows and loves who she thinks would be supportive through this process. She rings her husband, who's unfortunately away with work and uncontactable. She rings up her brothers and, you know, friends. And in the end, none of them answer. And in an act of desperation, she rings her mum. Now, she doesn't have a great relationship with her mum, largely because her mum has this kind of slightly narcissistic trait where she makes everything about her. So her mum turns up and she's in going through kind of contractions, and the doctor comes in and sees her kind of struggling with this and says to Sugar, oh, would you like a glass of water? To which her mum obviously replies, oh, I'd love a glass of water. It's that kind of everything's about me kind of attitude. You know, when Sugar's talking about what she's going through, everything is an opportunity for her to tell a story about, oh, well, when I was in labor, we didn't do it like that. We did it like this. You know, everything becomes about her. You see, this moment that is clearly meant to be about Sugar and about the birth she's about to have ends up being about her mum. I guess as I talk about that, we'll all know, have experienced some situations a bit like that. Situations where someone has said something which has nothing to do with us, but which we've assumed is about us. That moment when you say, shall I do the washing up? And someone else hears, they're saying that I never do the washing up. Or when we overhear a friend complimenting someone else and we interpret this as them saying that they don't think we're any good at that thing and maybe they don't even like us. You know, we have this capacity, right, to make things about us. You know, even when people aren't talking about us, in our minds, it's really about us. I think that's kind of like the moment we have here in the boat. Jesus says, watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees and Herod. And the disciples say, he's talking about us because we didn't bring any bread. It's like, he hasn't mentioned you. He hasn't mentioned bread. He's clearly talking about the Pharisees and Herod. But the disciples fall into that trap, which we all fall into. If the first is making everything about the physical, forgetting that there's spiritual truths and spiritual realities which are more important than those physical things, the second is assuming that everything is about us. We turn our faith into something which is primarily about what we have or haven't done. We think what matters is whether we've done everything expected of us. You know, so if I've put myself out for another person, if I've gone to church, if I've read my Bible, if I've given some money away, well, I'm doing well. Then I'm doing well. You know, God likes me at those moments. But if I've missed one or maybe more, maybe Jesus is secretly fuming with us. Maybe Jesus is ready to give up with us. I think there's two ways that this can play out specifically in our faith, and we see them kind of lived out in the Pharisees, and we see them lived out in the disciples here. If you make knowing God and enjoying the life he brings primarily about your performance, you will either end up like the Pharisees or like the disciples here. depending on how you think you're doing. If you think you're doing quite well, if you're like, oh, I'm basically doing the right sort of stuff. You know, I'm doing quite well, I'm loving people quite well, I'm being quite generous, I'm going to church, I'm reading my Bible, you know, I'm doing the kind of things you're meant to do. If you think, if you're able to deceive yourself that actually you're just a good person who does good things, then you will end up proud and self-righteous. That's where that takes you. You will end up like a Pharisee. I don't need Jesus because I'm a good person. I don't need forgiveness because basically I don't have anything which needs forgiving. If you make your faith about how well you're doing, then if you think you're doing well, you will end up self-obsessed, self-important, self-righteous, and judgmental, just like the Pharisees. Or it can play out entirely the opposite way, like the disciples, where you're aware that you don't get everything right. You're aware that sometimes you miss things. You're aware of your imperfections and your sins, and therefore you're terrified that you're not making the grade. Constantly worried that God will give up on you. When constantly worried that Jesus is going to call you out and say, you did kind of forget the bread. Constantly worried that you haven't met the mark. You haven't done what is required of you. Constantly striving to do more and more just in case you haven't quite done enough. If you make your faith about you, you will either think you're doing really well and be proud, or think you're not doing quite well enough and sink into despair. You see, they thought what mattered was physical bread, and they thought what Jesus cared about was what they hadn't done. But actually, the thing Jesus really wanted them to learn was clearly, I think here, the extent of what he was able to do. Because look at the dialogue at the end. When I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many basketfuls did you pick up? 12. When I broke the 7 loaves for the 4,000, how many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up? 7. Do you still not understand? Done. Like, that's clearly what he wanted them to get. Something about the extravagance of his provision. It was, if there's one lesson that Jesus seems to be hammering home here, it's that ultimately they collect from the abundance of what he provides. You see, when it comes to feeding people, Jesus is the equivalent of like cracking a nut with a sledgehammer or filling a shot glass with a fire hose. You know, it just inevitably, it's over the top. He does it in such a way that the leftovers are more than you had to begin with. He fulfills our needs to such an extent that even the crumbs that fall off are more than we could need. You see, what is it the disciples haven't understood? Well, it seems to be the excessive scope of what Jesus came to do. The fact that he came to meet our deepest needs. The fact that he came for everyone, not just for Jewish people. The fact that Jesus provides for us all, and that all that we need to do is receive. Why is Jesus making such a big deal of these leftovers here? Well, it's because it seems that the disciples haven't yet understood the scope of his power. They haven't yet grasped that nothing is impossible for him. They haven't yet understood that all that is required from them is to receive what Jesus provides. See, I think there's three lessons from the loaves. There's a warning against an unhelpful focus on the physical. There's a warning against making our faith all about what we have or haven't done. And then there's the reminder that Jesus provides, and that he provides in excess. I'm going to try and wrap it up here. And I want to wrap it up by asking you the question Jesus keeps asking the disciples. Have you not yet understood about the loaves? Because I think there'll be many of us in this room who have still got some learning from this lesson to do. We haven't quite mastered it yet. We haven't quite learnt all that the loaves have to teach us. Maybe for some of you, you don't actually know Jesus here today. You don't know him, you don't follow him, you haven't accepted what he came to do. Maybe you've just started coming to Grace Church, you know, you're still trying to work it out. Maybe you've been coming for a while. Maybe the thing that puts you off really getting on board and exploring Jesus and following him for yourself is all the things that you think you'd have to do if you actually went all in on following him. If you actually became a Christian, all those things you'd have to do. Now, I want to be clear. Being a Christian does change your life. But if you're put off by all the things you think you'd have to do, I think you might be at risk of not failing to understand about the loaves. Because following Jesus isn't about what you do, it's about what Jesus has done for you. It's about coming to him and simply collecting up the forgiveness, the love, the life which overflows out of what he did at the cross. If you're someone here who doesn't follow Jesus and is put off by that, I just want to encourage you, just learn the lesson of the loaves. Christianity is coming to Jesus and accepting what he provides for you. Maybe that's not you. Maybe some of you, though, are stuck in a joyless, guilt-ridden Christianity, where you're just constantly depressed at the ways you fail to be the person you want to be or the person that God calls you to be. If that's where you're at, I want to suggest maybe you have also forgotten the lesson of the loaves. You've forgotten the joy which can be found by coming to Jesus in all our sin, in all our brokenness, in all our helplessness, and just allowing him to meet that need in abundance. Just coming to him with nothing and just seeing how abundantly he meets those needs. If you're a Christian here today who is just constantly feeling weighed down by feelings of inadequacy and guilt, I want to suggest you need to learn the lesson of the loaves. Come to Jesus. Let him provide. It's not about you. Maybe some of you here today are physically stuffed but spiritually starving. You eat too much, you spend too much, you rest too much, you own too much, and yet you feel alone, unloved, empty, guilty, and without hope. Maybe you just need to learn the lesson of the loaves. Life isn't really found in the abundance of bread feeding our physical hunger. It's found in Jesus feeding our spiritual hunger. Maybe some of you here this afternoon, your mind is weighed down by some issue or problem you're facing. Maybe some of you are stuck in a really, really difficult marriage. Maybe some of you are battling with addiction. Maybe some of you are dealing with a perpetual lack of self-control in a certain area of your life. Maybe some of you are struggling with laziness or emptiness. And you, as you're sat here, hearing me speak about that, you think there's no solution to that problem. It's how you've always been, it's how you're always going to be. You just sit here and you just think, I'm just powerless against that. Maybe if that's where you're at, you just need to learn the lesson of the loaves. The lesson that Jesus specializes in dealing with those things that are impossible for you. And that when he deals with them, he deals with them so comprehensively that the leftovers are better than we could have ever imagined. It seems to me that in all those moments I've just talked about there, wherever you find yourself in those, there's a lesson to be learned from the loaves. And that the amount of airtime Mark gives to this lesson indicates it's a pretty big lesson. It's not like a kind of peripheral, on the fringes of Christianity kind of thing that you might be helpful to get your head on. It's kind of right at the heart of it. So maybe next time you find yourself in one of those situations, maybe you could just give yourself a little nudge and just say, oh, I need to remember the lesson of the loaves. I've forgotten it again. You know, I've been so distracted by all the things going on that I've just lost sight of the lesson of the loaves. And you could just give yourself a little nudge. Oh, wait a minute. Jesus can intervene in that situation. Actually, it's not about me. Actually, there is something more real and more essential than those physical needs and desires. And maybe in that lesson, you'll just find a way out of your obsession with the physical, your obsession with yourself, and you'll find your way to the person of Jesus, who provides in abundance for us. Let me pray, and then we'll wrap it up.